Before we begin our study in the book of Exodus, there's something I came across this week during my reading. I always am reading several books at one time. It's really quite confusing. But I happened to come across something that stood out in my mind. I read it over and over and over. There was a phrase I came across in the book that a rabbi used long ago, and the phrase was, a donkey loaded with books. And the rabbi uses this phrase, a donkey loaded with books, to refer to people who constantly study, who constantly learn, but they're still donkeys. I have a visual aid here prepared by Fritz, by Phil. Now, he just did this 2 minutes ago. I said, Phil, draw me a picture of a donkey loaded with books, and look what he did. Okay? So there's our donkey loaded with books. Now, the reason this phrase stuck out to me is because I don't want to be a donkey loaded with books, where all the study, all the learning only affects me from the neck up, but I'm still a donkey from the neck down. There's a story about Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who lived a couple hundred years ago. And in a town nearby, a man had just died. And this man was a student of Torah, the Talmud, and he had studied many of the commentaries. He could quote chapter and verse and long passages from books on halakha and the commentaries, and very, very knowledgeable. And so a messenger was sent to Rabbi Nachman to ask him to come and eulogize this man at his funeral. And Rabbi Nachman didn't want to go. And the messenger asked, why? And Rabbi Nachman said, how shall I eulogize him? A sack of books has been lost? In other words, the rabbi knew this man that he had tremendous learning. He knew many facts, but it had not truly affected his heart. And I don't want to be that. I don't think you want to be that either. How can we prevent ourselves from being a donkey loaded with books? You know, many times we've heard and even taught the analogy of the donkey that Yeshua rode on when he came to Jerusalem. And I've heard sermons and teachings and given some myself, for this donkey represents you and me. And that we are to be a vehicle to bring Messiah to others. An analogy is good as far as it goes, but there are a couple of errors in it. First error is, this donkey is taking Yeshua to his death. And the second is, after the donkey had brought Yeshua to Jerusalem, the donkey was still just a donkey. It hadn't changed. We're not to be donkeys that Yeshua rides on. We are to be yokebaits with him, pulling together his load and his burden. Now, how can we make sure that we're not just a donkey loaded with books, but instead we are people who don't just fill our minds with facts, but fill our hearts with the Messiah himself? As I thought about this, it occurred to me that there are two kinds of people. There are people who are learners, and then there are people who are teachable. Don't ever think for a moment that they're the same thing. Have you ever met people who study and study and learn, but they're like the people Paul writes about in 2 Timothy, says they are always learning but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth? They have minds filled with facts, but the truth is something alien to them, something they cannot recognize. What is it that makes a person teachable? Well, let's talk about the person who learns all the time but is not teachable. A person who learns all the time, studies all the time, but is unteachable is the kind of person who can only learn from his own selected teachers. He can only learn within the holding pen of his own doctrine and his own denomination. Maybe holding pen was not a very polite way to put it, but he only learned within a certain theological box. He can only learn if it's on WCRF or if it only comes from this rabbi, or comes from this particular favorite teacher, out of this book from this publisher. He can't learn from someone he deems to know less than himself. He can't learn from those he feels have wronged him in the past in some way. And by no means can he learn from his enemies. Now, a person who's teachable learns from everyone and everything, even if it's a matter of learning what not to do or what not to be like. I know, I remember having several discussions with different individuals, some of them much, much, much more educated than I am, knew much more than I did about the languages of the scriptures and background and history and so on, but absolutely and totally unteachable. Because they had chosen who their teachers would be, and only from them would they ever learn anything. So no matter what God brought to their life, they were just a donkey loaded with books. And when they die, what can we say about them? A sack of books is lost. I don't want to be that way. And as we come to the Torah today, as we come to the study of Shemot, of Exodus, let's pray that we are not just adding more books on our backs, but we are actually hosting Messiah in our hearts instead. Let it, the Word of God, change our wills, change our emotions, change the way we live. And let us be like the many rabbis in the Talmud and in the commentaries who talk about how they've learned much from their teachers but learned more from their students. Like the rabbis who say that every person he meets, good, bad, wise, foolish, is a lesson from God to him. Learn to love people, because when you learn to love people, you can learn the lesson God has placed in their lives, in your life, to teach you. Don't be a donkey loaded with books. Okay? Well, let's go to the Torah. And thank you, Phil, for the drawing. I just want that to be an image we have in our minds. I know when I first read this, I just shared with you, it's an image that just won't go out of my mind. It's a warning to me. And I want to be an image that's in all of our minds. I want us to be people who are people of light, not just people who can point to the light, people of wisdom, not just people who can quote adages and Bible verses. I want us to be people who walk the talk, so that the message and the messenger are the same thing. Okay? Well, I'm not even going to attempt to cover our Torah portion this morning. We're just going to move along and dip in a few places. Let me give you some advice about studying Torah, something I've learned from experience. Some people tend to focus on the details only and miss the big picture. Others see the big picture and miss the details. We're going to do both. Learn to zoom in and then zoom out. Zoom in on a detail and a fact and a lesson hidden in the words. Then zoom out once again to get the context of the whole message. Because it's so easy to zoom in on some detail, we don't zoom out and miss some of the important outlines. I mean, once again, here's an example. Here we see a Jewish man who is to some degree accused or hated by his brother. And so he flees to a distant land, takes a Gentile bride, and then is sent back to his brethren to be their deliverer. Where have we heard that theme before? Right? With Joseph. With Messiah. And there are others through Scripture we will encounter who do the exact same thing. There's something here God's trying to emphasize and drive home to us. So there's a big picture here we don't want to miss. But let's go to a detail. Let's pick it up in, we'll start with chapter 1, verse 1. No better place to start than at the beginning. And these are the Shemot, the names. That's why this book is called Shemot. It's not called Exodus. That's the English name we give it. Exodus means somebody leaving. God calls this book Shemot, which means names. Names are very important, especially in this very first parasha of Shemot. Because we're given the names of the tribes of Israel, but the main characters in this reading, we're not given their names. Or we're given to they're given to us later in the reading or later in the book of Exodus. Let me give you an example. If you go to chapter 2. Now see, if you or I had written this, we would have started out, Amram from the house of Levi took a daughter of Levi named Jochebed. That's how we would have written it. But notice the names are not given. A man went from the house of Levi and he took a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and gave birth to a son, Moses. But the word Moses isn't there, is it? So we have a mom, we have a dad, we have a child, and still don't know their names. And then we see the sister come along. We know the sister to be Miriam, but her name's not given. And then the baby's placed in the basket and sitting down the river, and Pharaoh's daughter finds it. Her name's not given. In fact, Pharaoh's name's not given. Pharaoh's just a title. We go on and on, and there's just no names. But finally, Moses is introduced. Then later on, we find out the sister's name's Miriam, and that the parents' names are Amram and Jochebed. It's almost as if God says certain things have to be accomplished before I award a name. Certain things have to be accomplished, and then you get the name. And what's amazing in this portion, we receive God's name. He gives us his personal name to Moses there on Mount Sinai. But nowhere in the Torah do we find out what Pharaoh's name is. He's not given a name. He's just called by his title, Pharaoh. He's nameless throughout this. Maybe this helps explain, at least it does to me, why in the book of Revelation it talks about how at the judgment we're all given new names. Not the ones our parents gave us, but a name that reflects what has been accomplished in us and through us. A name that reflects who we are, because in the spiritual realm, a name is the person himself. I know there's a movement today that I believe violates the rules of Torah and of the New Testament, which says we should pronounce God's name all the time, whenever we refer to God. Yeshua never did this. Never once. Except maybe one time in John, under very special conditions, he hints at God's name. But other times he refers to God as Father, or refers to God as Heaven, because he did not want to misuse God's name. It was so holy. We are commanded to sanctify God's name, set it apart. Do not use it in common conversation. Because God's name is more than just a spelling lesson. God's name cannot even be spelled. God's name is who he is. Okay? And your name that God gives you will be who you are, who you truly are. So we want to sanctify God's name. And the way we do that is by sanctifying ourselves, setting ourselves apart to serve him fully and wholeheartedly. But the first two people in our story we have names for are two people mentioned once and never again in Scripture. The two midwives, the two little nobodies, the two little disobedient women who refused Pharaoh's order. Because the whole book of Exodus rests on these two women. God names them first. Because if they had not disobeyed Pharaoh's orders, Moses would not have survived. The children of Israel would not have survived. And the nameless Pharaoh would have won the day. Remember the secrets of spiritual powers in hiddenness and smallness, humility and anonymity. And God uses these two Hebrew midwives. And then he rewards them with houses of their own. Well, let's look even smaller in detail. Let's go down to verse 8. Chapter 1, verse 8. says a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And now, that phrase, did not know Joseph, can also be translated, who would not acknowledge Joseph. I'm sure he knew about Joseph, but refused to acknowledge what this young Jewish man had accomplished for the sake of Egypt. He said to his people, "Behold, the people, the children of Israel, are more numerous and stronger than we. Come, let us outsmart it, lest it become numerous, and it may be that if a war will occur, it too may join our enemies and wage war against us and go up from the land." Notice that Pharaoh is motivated by fear. That's how the enemy works. I want to show you something that's kind of interesting. That phrase, "lest it become numerous," it's pin yarbo in Hebrew. There are the Hebrew letters. And as we read on a little bit further, in verse 11, it says, "So they appointed taskmasters over it in order to humiliate or afflict it with their burdens. It built storage cities for Pharaoh." Someone asked the question, what were these storage cities built to store? And the rabbis say, all the wealth that Joseph accumulated for Egypt. Isn't that interesting? Very possible. And it gives the names of the cities, "but as much as they would afflict it, so it would increase, and so it would spread out." Now that phrase for "so it would increase," or "thus it increased," is kin yarbo, there in verse 12. Now look at the Hebrew letters. You notice how they look identical? Except for one small change. You see the small change is in the very first letter. This letter is a pay. And the first letter of kin yarbo, "thus it increased," is a kaf. And the only difference is this little dot hanging from the top of the pay. Now, the letter pay, what does the word pay mean? Mouth. And it's a picture of a mouth, right? Upper jaw, lower jaw, and here are the teeth. But the rabbis say the teeth were pulled. So they added all the hardship, all the labor on the children of Israel, lest it become numerous. But the more they did, thus it increased. God pulled Pharaoh's teeth. There's a tiny little detail. Remember Yeshua said, not one jot, not one tittle passed in the Torah till everything's fulfilled. Here's one of them. Here's a little detail I'm sure Messiah was aware of. That little tiny dot changes everything. But there's an important lesson here in this little tiny detail of Torah. There's a powerful lesson here. Think about it for a minute. Pharaoh issued a decree that all the baby boys of Israel die. Did they die? There's only one that the Torah records being thrown into the river, and that's Moses. And he became the deliverer. But what happened to the firstborn of Egypt later on? They all died. Not only of the children, but of the cattle as well. He said, throw the baby boys into the Nile River. Let the Nile River drown them. But the only ones I ever see drowning in the Nile River are Pharaoh's army. And then, what does God do? The decree is cast the children into the river, so Moses' mother, she makes a tevat, an ark, puts him in it, sails it down the river. And who does it go to? Pharaoh's daughter. Look at the poetic justice here. Pharaoh in fear tried to destroy the deliverer, tried to destroy the boys. Because the Midrash Rabbah, the ancient Bible studies that Daniel Lancaster calls, and I like that, gives us some interesting information. These ancient Bible studies, these are thousands of years old. These are things that Yeshua would have studied and known about when he was walking the earth. And it says that Pharaoh decreed against his own people too. And why was this? because his astrologers told him, quote, "The mother of Israel's Savior is already pregnant with him," unquote. So he tried to destroy the baby boys to kill the deliverer. Now, where do we hear this theme again? In the Gospels, when Herod decreed that all the baby boys be destroyed in the attempt of destroying the deliverer. But here's the beautiful thing. So she puts Moses in the Nile, the Teva, the ark, floats down the Nile, and as little Miriam is watching this, she's probably thinking, oh no, it's going right to Pharaoh's daughter. She's going to take this baby and tell Dad he's going to have it killed. But that's not what happened. Think about this. Just let this sink in for a second. The one who's going to deliver Israel is fed by Pharaoh, clothed by Pharaoh, housed by Pharaoh, educated by Pharaoh, is given wealth and position by Pharaoh, and much of the training that Moses would depend upon later to deliver the children of Israel came directly because he grew up in the house of Pharaoh. In Pharaoh's attempt to destroy the people of Israel and their deliverer, he became the instrument of God to raise up the deliverer. Now let this sink in about what kind of God we have. Don't miss this. Our God is not like a pro football fullback running through a schoolyard of kindergartners, just knocking away and just making his path and destroying everything in his path. That's not how our God works. Our God works this way. He wants to get from here to there, and no matter what kind of barriers, obstacles, speed bumps we may put in his way, the enemy may put in his way, what he does, he transforms every obstacle into a blessing and a tool to help him accomplish his task. That's an incredible thing. Incredible. If we could just grab hold of that lesson, just that much, really grab hold of it and never forget it, we could then begin to live this redeemed life the way it's supposed to be lived. Our sufferings would be over. At least the sufferings we make for ourselves. In the world, we're going to have tribulation. But as I've said before, I'm going to emphasize again, for any suffering that God ordains for your life, he gives you grace to go through that suffering. And it's quite durable, quite endurable, quite tolerable. He will not give you grace for the worry that you add to the mix, for the anxiety you add in, for the fears, for the tribulations, the worries, all the nervousness, all the nervous stomachs, the acid indigestion you add to the mix. He won't give you grace for that. He gives you grace for the trouble he adds to your life, not for the trouble you add. God will give you grace for the trouble he brings into your life and ordains to your life, for the tribulation, the pain of suffering. We all have some. He will not give you grace for the pain, tribulation you add to your life. For example, what if Jochebed and Miriam could have taken a time machine up to the present day, gone back and read the Torah and seen exactly how the story would end? Jochebed would have her baby boy, put him in the ark, Miriam sailing down the Nile, and watch him go right into Pharaoh's daughter's arms, bring him back to me. I'll nurse him and get paid for it. We'll watch him grow up. Now we'll miss him for 40 years while he's a shepherd. He'll come back and deliver us. What a great story. Do you think there'd be any worry? No. Any anxiety? Nope. None. No fear, because they know exactly how it's going to turn out. Now, would they miss Pharaoh during that time? Yeah. And God would give him grace for that. Well, is she missing while he's being raised in Pharaoh's house and seeing raised as an Egyptian stuff as a Jew? Yeah, but God gave her grace for that. With 40 years he's gone and they don't have news of him, God gives her grace for that. But see, she didn't know the end of the story from the beginning. And I imagine when Jochebed, this woman of great faith, put the baby in the little ark and sailed down the Nile, She wasn't sure how it was going to end, but she hoped and prayed that God would bring about a good end to this. But there's probably worry and anxiety and fear, and that God will not give us grace for. We are asked to trust that God knows the end from the beginning, and He does all things well, and He will accomplish the thing He purposes to accomplish. And He asks us to trust Him at that and be at peace. But if we choose to worry and fume and stew about it, we'll worry and fume and stew about it. Do you understand the message here? Okay, Mike, I saw your hand.
I just want to ask a question. Who named Moses?
Pharaoh's daughter. Yeah. Pharaoh's daughter. Now, some people, let's go to that for a moment. Yes, absolutely. If you go down to that place, it's in chapter 2. And it's in verse 10. For the boy grew up, and she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh, and he was a son to her. She called his name Moshe, as she said, for I drew him from the water. Now, people have tried to make a connection with the word for drew, which is the word masa. But the thing is, Pharaoh's daughter wouldn't have been speaking Hebrew. She spoke Egyptian. Now, what's interesting is that if you look at many of the Egyptian names, for example, Ramesses. You notice the name Moses there? That's an Egyptian name, not a Hebrew name. There's another, I probably misspelled this, but there's another Pharaoh named Thutmose or Toothmose or something like Toothmose, I don't know. But once again, you see the M-O-S-C. What does this mean? This is an Egyptian word which means Ra is born, or a child of Ra, a child of Toth, or whoever this god is, or Toth is born. And there are a number of pharaohs that end, their names end in M-O-S-E-S, or M-O-S-E. So probably what Pharaoh's daughter said when she drew the child for us, she said, a child. A child. And she named him that. A birth. She called him Moshe. And she called him her child, her Moshe. But the Hebrew word for draw is masa, which is also very similar. So what's kind of interesting is that Moses really is an Egyptian name, and he carries this name all through history, and even today is called by this Egyptian name, which really helps authenticate the fact the Torah is genuine. Otherwise, why in the world would someone who's writing this story possibly thousands of years later, some claim, have given the deliverer an Egyptian name? But it was an Egyptian name. So, does that help answer that a little bit?
Yeah. Okay.
I want to go back to second for about God's sovereignty and look at something that has always kind of mystified me. Let's go to chapter 3 for a moment. Remember when God is calling Moses, he's 80 years old at this point, calling him to go back and deliver the people of Israel from Egyptian bondage. Moses has a few questions he wants answered first. I guess you could call them excuses. The first excuse is in around verse 11. Moses replied to God, who am I? A little later on, he's going to ask, who are you? You know, what's your name? But right now he's asking, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should take the children of Israel out of Egypt? In chapter 3, verse 12, the next verse, God answers, and he said, for I shall be with you. In other words, Moses, you're a nobody, but I'll be with you. And I know I've shared this so many times, but I love saying it. It's that Moses was 40 years old when he fled from Egypt. He then spent the next 40 years in Midian, being a shepherd, and he's now 80 years old. And the way we know this is that Stephen, in Acts chapter 7, when he's kind of given a review at his trial, a review of Jewish history, he gives us the ages. And he says that Moses, when he was approaching 40 years old, you know, he found an Egyptian beating up a Hebrew slave, and he killed the Egyptian. And then it says 40 years later, he was a shepherd in Midian, and he saw the burning bush. And then we know when Moses was 120, another 40 years, that's when he died. And someone summarized it this way. Moses spent the first 40 years of his life learning he was a somebody. He spent the next 40 years learning he was a nobody. And he spent the last 40 years learning what God could do with a nobody. Isn't that great? But anyways, God says, this is your sign that I have sent you. When you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain. And then God says, and that is kind of an odd sign, isn't it? What kind of sign is that? You're giving me a sign that won't be fulfilled until after we don't need a sign anymore. But you know, many of the signs God gives us are signs that exist in the future. He's saying, you've got to trust me on this one. You're really got to trust me on this. But I think there's something more than that. God can actually put a certainty into our hearts, the certainty of a certain future event, a certainty, and we grasp and we embrace that certainty. That becomes our sign. It's not one we can show anybody else. This is a sign that he gives Moses. This is your sign. This is for you, Moses. You want to know who you are? You're nobody. I'll be with you. And this is a certainty I'm going to place in your heart. And every time you think of me, you must think of the certainty. You, with Israel, will worship me on this mountain. Well, let's go down a little bit further. The third excuse is in chapter 4. He says, but they will not believe me, and they will not listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. So in other words, what's the sign for them, Lord? In verse 2, the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. He said, cast it on the ground. He cast it on the ground. It became a snake. So if you're taking notes, write down staff for sign number 1. Verse 4, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp its tail. He stretched out his hand and grasped it tightly, became a staff in his palm. So that they shall believe that the Lord, the God of their forefathers, appeared to you, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. The Lord said further to him, bring your hand to your bosom. And he brought it, his hand to his bosom. Then he withdrew it, and behold, his hand was leprous like snow. He said, return your hand to your bosom. Then he returned his hand to his bosom. Then he removed it. From his bosom, behold, it reverted to be like his flesh. It shall be that if they do not believe you and do not heed the voice of the first sign, they'll believe the voice of the latter sign. So you're taking note, sign number 2 is the hand. Then verse 9. And it shall be that if they do not believe even these 2 signs and do not heed your voice, then you shall take from the water of the river, pour it on out on the dry land, the water that you shall take from the river will become blood when it is on the dry land. Sign 3 is blood. Now, these are not the signs I would have equipped Moses with. This is one of the reasons I'm not God, never will be. Because I would have let him shoot fireworks out into the staff, or blast holes through walls of the staff, or turn Pharaoh's soldiers into wiener dogs, or something, something really bizarre. I mean, that would be impressive, wouldn't it? No doubt, this man is sent by God. These signs are so personal, though. In fact, the first one there, at least, the Egyptian magicians could imitate. What's God trying to teach? Look at the 3 things you wrote down. The staff. Turn it to a serpent, turn it back to a staff. Now, what is it you use to grasp the staff? A hand. The hand turns leprous, turns back to a healthy hand. And what is it that gives life and strength to the hand? Blood. What God is showing Moses here is that he is the Lord of all realms. The physical realm of all the things out there that are not part of me, but which I can grasp, which I can manipulate. All the material things of the world, he's Lord of those. My very body, this earth suit that I walk around in, he's Lord of that. And my very life, because the life, the soul is in the blood, he's Lord of that. He's creator of everything. And just at his word, he can reveal the physical for what it is and restore it to us, because the staff from this point on is called the staff of the Lord. He can take this hand, and he can reveal that it's dying. This is dead stuff. So while there is life in it, use it for me, and I will resurrect it. And even though it dies, I will resurrect it. And your very life, that hiddenmost part of you, your very nephesh, your soul, that's mine as well. That's mine as well. You see, a God like that, you can't lose with. You just can't lose. Go to Isaiah 54 for a second. I was looking at this just this morning. And what an incredible passage this is. Look at the last verse of Isaiah 54, one I'm sure you've all heard many times. No weapon that is formed against you will prosper. And we've seen that already with Pharaoh. The Nile River used to drown the boys. It drowned Pharaoh's armies instead. The children Pharaoh tried to kill, they didn't die. But Pharaoh's son and the firstborn of Egypt died. And everything that Pharaoh brought against Moses and Israel was turned right back on his head, measure for measure. No weapon that is formed against you will prosper. And every tongue that accuses you in judgment, you will condemn. Now, by the way, that's not a commandment. We'd like to think that's a commandment. So every time somebody criticizes us, we just turn out and just lash out at them with our lightsaber of a tongue, just slash them to ribbons. That's what it's saying. He doesn't say you shall condemn or you're commanded to condemn every tongue that accuses you. No. It says that every tongue that accuses you in judgment, you'll condemn. How? Through your life. You live the life you're supposed to live, and every accusation that comes against you will be exposed as a lie. If you waste your existence trying to silence every accuser, you'll just waste your existence. Because you have an accuser of the brethren who never needs to sleep. So you live your life the way it's supposed to be lived. Okay? And notice this. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord. This is your heritage. If you serve the Lord, this belongs to you. Isn't that a wonderful thing? That's why the book of Shemot starts out with the sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why? To show that these people are in covenant relationship with God, they have a heritage from God, and God is going to protect them. And God had already told them, you're going to be slaves in another country for so many years, then at that time I'll bring you out. And he did. This is our heritage. But, and their vindication is from me, declares the Lord. Now back up one verse. This is an interesting verse. So many of you may not realize this verse comes, which is also familiar, comes before the verse we just read. Behold, I myself have created the smith who blows the fire of coals and brings out a weapon for its work. And I have created the destroyer to ruin, or the destroyer to destroy. Who is the destroyer? Who comes not but to steal and to kill and to destroy? Satan. And God says, listen, even he is mine. Don't be afraid of him. I've created him to destroy because there are things in this world that need destroyed. There are things in this world that need shaken, things in this world that need burned. But if you belong to me, then you're immune from this. Your heritage is that no weapon formed against you will prosper. No accusing tongue will stand uncondemned. This is your heritage. Isn't that a wonderful promise? This is a God who's sovereign. This is a Pharaoh whose teeth have been pulled when it comes to you. He might dumb on us a bit, but just slap him down and go on with your life. Yeah, Dan, I see your hand up.
That's not for this world. That's
for this world. Absolutely for this world. Yes, it is. You say, no, wait a minute. Don't think about that Satan, your life cannot be taken. Let's look at All right, somebody mentioned the Holocaust. Let's look at Messiah on the cross. Here's the question. Was Messiah murdered, or did he lay down his life of his own free will? Okay. If he had not laid down his life of his own free will, it would have been an act of murder. Now, as far as the executioners are concerned, it was murder. But from God's side of things, oh my, what's that? But from God's side of things, God was in control. Now notice how you can look at this from two different sides. From the human side, from the enemy side, we've killed the Messiah. But we look from God's side of things, Messiah gave up his life. Now let's bring that to our own experience. None of us know how we're going to die. We may just die of an illness, we may die in a car wreck, God forbid, die of old age, we might die as a martyr. Well, let me suggest something to you. When you die, they'll put an obituary in the paper, there might be an article about you, and people talk, oh, he died of a heart attack. Oh, he died because some drunk driver rammed him. Oh, he died because they put him to death because he stood for truth. Or he died because the surgery failed, or whatever. But what's it going to look like from God's eyes? From God's side, it's this. That person submitted and laid down their life for me back when they were 10 years old, 20 years old, 25, whatever it is. They laid down their life to me and gave me ownership of their life. So their life has always been mine. I called them home at this particular time. Now, from the world's side, they look like a murderer killed them. Not from my side. Their life belonged to me from day one. It's a complex issue. But we must understand that the way that things look from the physical and the way things look from the spiritual are different. Give ownership of your life to God now. Make your bodies living sacrifices to Him now. Take up your cross, an instrument of death, now. Consider yourself to be dead to this world now. So when finally your body does cease to function, however that comes about, that's right, your life is with Him all along. You said, Robin. Yes. Exactly. Good point. Right. Let me quote that for the tape, what you just said. Without an eternal perspective, the truth does not play out. You are exactly right. Exactly right. No. No. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And I see what you're saying. Yes. I understand your question now better than. Yes. Right. Right. But we need to live this truth now. Right. We need to live this truth right now. Yeah. See, let's look at it this way. If I'm spiritual and my mind is right, there might be some guy coming at me with a sword or a gun, and he's getting ready to kill me, and he will kill me in about 10 seconds. So from every witness's viewpoint, this guy took my life and killed me, and then he gets put on trial and, you know, whatever. But from my viewpoint, if I have a spiritual mindset, what is my viewpoint? Will the absence of the body be home with the Lord? You know, I mean, it's like this is the next natural transition for me. For the spiritual person, death has no sting and the grave has no victory. But for the one who doesn't have that eternal perspective, death does have a sting and the grave has the final say. We didn't. Yes. Yeah. Yes, Phil.
It doesn't really matter how you die, whether it was by the hand of wicked men or naturally, basically. You know,
exactly.
Regardless if it was by the hand of the enemy, it was by the hand of God.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we reach that point, when you see the God of court coming at you, well, it was
fine. Yes.
And it was fine.
Mm-hmm. And I think we can underestimate, there's no truth what you're saying. And, you know, think about it. If a spiritual man dies this way, men have died this way, you think, oh, how terrible, how awful, how... Yes, it's very sinful. It was a terrible thing from the world's viewpoint. But even that person's death, people begin to remember what he said. They'll carry on the work that he had. In fact, maybe he is a good thing he died then, because if he had lived longer, he would have fallen. I think of Hezekiah. God let him know he was going to die. And Hezekiah went, lay on the bed, turned his face to the wall, and just threw a fit. He just went into a depression, went into a funk, and prayed that his life be extended. And because his life was extended, terrible things befell Israel. He made a terrible mistake. He took the enemy, who he thought were friends, showed them all the wealth in his treasure house and his chambers, and that was a terrible thing to do. And destruction came because his life was extended. Whereas if he had died at that time, when God originally decreed, that would not have happened. We need to let God be sovereign. He does all things well, even though it may not look that way from the world's perspective, but from that eternal perspective. There is a day coming when we will look back and we will see every fiber that God wove in creation and in life and in history. We're going to say, wow, what an incredible thing God's accomplished. It's all a poem and it all rhymes. It all rhymes. And Jeannie?
I was just thinking, with what you're sharing, is in fact the only possible way that we are given that
yes.
That
yes. Yes. To always live with the knowledge that my life is hid with God. My life is hid with Messiah in God. You must live that way. Live that way. And with that perspective, and you'll experience the truth of this. Doesn't mean you won't have tribulation. Well, of course you will, but you have God's grace to go along with it. And even that tribulation is a growing experience. It's all engineered to bring out your best. But if you throw that perspective out and you walk by sight, not by faith, oh my, then life gets pretty miserable then. Yeah. Vern.
But just as Moses and Yeshua were saved when Herod and the Pharaoh tried to kill all the infants, it's not God's will that children die before they reach the age of accountability. Especially abortion.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah, there's a lot of things. God has given... Boy, this gets in a whole, this is a good bait midrash topic. How God has restricted himself. God has restricted himself in this world. He really has. But when it comes to a person who's yielded his life fully to him, that restriction is removed to a tremendous degree. Yeah. God has restricted himself. We ask why do terrible things happen? Children are aborted, Holocaust take place, there are wars, there's death, there's destruction. God's restricted himself. And totally devote ourselves to the Lord. So no matter what the enemy throws our way, no matter what he throws our way, no matter how painful it may be, God's grace comes along and it results in greater reward, greater refinement, greater light, greater accomplishment for his kingdom. And we don't have to fear the enemy at all. We're commanded not to fear him. Yeah, Valerie.
So, do we not fight for our lives?
Sure.
If we get cancer, are we not
I think you should choose life. I think you have to choose life. John will call, get you to say, if I let you talk now, I'll completely forget what I'm about to say, which is probably for the best anyway, but... I read about a rabbi who, this is maybe within the last 50 years or so. He was up in age. He was diagnosed with cancer, and it was incurable. I mean, there was no question about this. Cancer was going to take his life. Although treatments could be offered, radiation, chemo, and so on, to extend his life. And so he had just decided that... He was just going to forgo the treatment. He was just going to let the cancer take its natural course, and he was just gone. But when he saw the worry in his wife's eyes, and he saw the hurt in her eyes, he decided for her sake to go ahead and go through the treatment. So for her sake, he could stay a little bit longer. Isn't that interesting? His life is so turned outward towards others, in giving to others, that he was willing to go through the extra suffering of the chemo and the radiation because it'd give his wife comfort to spend a little bit more time with her. And that's the only reason he did it. So, you know, there's no blanket rule. But should we defend our lives? Sure. Should we defend the lives of others? Yes. That's a commandment. That's absolutely a commandment. You fight for righteousness? Sure. Yeah, we're to be runners, farmers, and warriors. Remember, that's what Paul told Timothy. We're to be all three. We need to know when to be which. But yeah, I mean, if someone's trying to come and I'm not a pacifist by any stretch of the imagination. If someone comes in and harm my family, well, they're going to get harmed or killed. Because I'm going to put my life on the line before I let them hurt one of my kids. If it's just me, I'm going to defend my life to the death. Because I am to choose life. And that's a commandment. That's a very clear cut. So I don't even have to think about it. But, so, anyways, John.
You've been born in an inadequate job.
Oh, thanks. You're too kind. Yes.
Grant, it seems like the whole key to being victorious or joyous in it is recognizing the tragedy as a deceit.
Yeah.
When you see it as a deceit rather than a true tragedy, mm-hmm. you're able to say, I am God, and this is what he deemed I needed in
yes.
my life.
Yes. Right. Yeah, they're going to become... This brings up a great point. The rabbis give a great truth here, a tremendous truth, and we need to hold on to this. Let me quote something to you from the Midrash Rabbah. Let's see if I can find it here. I've got it marked, I'm sure. I know where. I had to write it down because it's not in that one. This is from the Midrash Rabbah in the book of Numbers. And this is what it says. It's talking about, it uses the word Goel, which is redeemer. And of course, the Jews are looking for a final Goel, a final redeemer, looking for Messiah to come. And listen to what they say. This is what they wrote thousands of years ago. The final Goel, the final redeemer, will be the same as the first. The first Goel, Moshe, who first exposed himself to Israel and then was hidden, he went in the wilderness for 40 years. The final Goel will also first expose himself to them and then be hidden. Okay, you see the picture? Moses, he comes to deliver and he kills an Egyptian. And then he's hidden away in Midian for 40 years. And then he comes back and accomplishes the deliverance. Messiah came. Now he's hidden away. And when he returns, he'll complete the deliverance. So the rabbis say there's a pattern here. Now the pattern is one that applies very personally as well. And the rabbis explain it this way. They say God gives us a promise. And then what happens, I'm putting this in my own words, when God gives a promise of some good thing he's going to do in our lives as individuals or as a people, what we do is we then imagine what that's going to look like when the promise is fulfilled. And this is important. And the next thing God has to do is debunk that vision that we have. And only then, after he debunks our idea of what that deliverance looks like, then he brings the deliverance. Isn't that incredible? That's an amazing thing. So what is it you're holding on to that God's going to do, and you imagine what it's going to look like, and when he's going to do it, he says, sorry, can't do that. That's your idea. I have to completely disillusion you. And that happens in our Torah portion. Moses, Aaron, they come to the elders of Israel. He does his signs. They say, hallelujah, the deliverer is here. Our time is up. We're going to get going. And what does Pharaoh do? Takes all the straw away. Well, you have to keep the same quota of bricks, no straw. Then all the elders come back to Moses there, and what have you done with us? Everything's worse than it was. God had to debunk their idea of what their deliverance would look like. And when that happened, what does God say? And this is right at the tail end of our portion today. Chapter 6, verse 1 is the last verse of our portion. All right, let's back up. This is just too good. Back up to chapter 5, verse 20. They encountered Moses and Aaron standing opposite them, or opposed to them. As they left Pharaoh's presence, they said to them, "May the Lord look upon you and judge, for you have made our very scent abhorrent in the eyes of Pharaoh and the eyes of his servants, to place a sword in their hands to murder us." So the elders go and accuse Moses. What does Moses do? Moses returned to the Lord and said, "My Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why have you sent me?" In other words, everything's a mess. Nothing you said is going to happen has happened. "From the time I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he did evil to this people, but you did not rescue your people." Then what does God say? The Lord said to Moses, and circle the word now. "Now you will see what I shall do to Pharaoh." You see that? I think to reveal their hearts and their lack of faith, and to debunk their ideas of what this deliverance would look like. And he has to debunk our ideas of what our deliverance looks like. How many times have you prayed and prayed and prayed for something, and God just put a final no to your prayer? And then later, the prayer was answered in a way you never would have expected. There's the pattern. That's the pattern for the ages. We're in this 2,000-year period between the first revelation of the Deliverer and the final revelation of Him, where God's debunking every idea, every human attempt at bringing deliverance to this world. And then finally, He will bring His. And what has happened first? A tribulation, 7 years of Jacob's trouble, a time when hope is totally gone, and the Jewish people, especially because they're the key to everything, will throw up their hands and just say there's no hope. And they'll turn to God. And then God says, "Now you're going to see."
Yes.
Isn't that an amazing thing? Okay. Jennifer, your hand is up first, then Brian.
I was just thinking before you were teaching, I didn't want to read any books, but it happened to be a book that was in my desk when the teacher was saying it. But it was the parallel story of the three girls surviving the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
They come from the same village originally. And their separate tales. And the one girl, her family moved from their village to Tucker Gulf trying to get away from the Germans. And once they end up in this town where they knew she was Jewish,
mm-hmm.
She'd go to school, and of course they would make through the further towns and everything else because they knew that her family had just showed up and they had to be Jewish. And so she bought a cross. And she would wear the cross on her neck when she would go to school because she would tell the kids know that she was Catholic. Hope that they would leave her alone. And basically, outwardly, other than when she was in the home, had renounced her Judaism. Well,
mm-hmm.
Her family was being seized and compassionate. And it was during that time there that she came from, as a child, came from Greece, exactly what it meant to be Jewish. And then the story survived and lived her entire life to make, you know, to be a Jew, to make sure her children knew what it was to be Jewish. Mm-hmm. And to, but for her, I mean, it's the same type of thing. Her deliverance from the child's eye at that moment was to come by wearing a cross. But her real deliverance came from making it through.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. Incredible. Thanks for that story. It's great. Fern.
You mentioned children of Israel living in Egypt under Joseph and how fortunate it was for them with Joseph as being, you know, on their side. And then seeing the structures that were built in Egypt, the pyramids,
yeah,
and all the colossal structures. And that magician able to perform other miracles other than the snakes. And so from a superstitious standpoint, seeing how great Egypt was, them looking for a deliverer when it came to Moses' time, and them, mm-hmm. and this Pharaoh not recognizing the children of Israel.
Yes.
So there's just an opposite mm-hmm. thing right at that crucial moment. Children of yes. Israel seeing all the colossal stuff.
Yeah.
And hear where their deliverance is coming from.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it was all prophesied so they would know God had it all under control. You know, this is probably a good place to close, and Vern kind of reminds me of it. We opened up, talked about how Joseph and Moses, their lives follow a similar pattern, right? But now let's look at how their lives are so opposite. Joseph started off as a shepherd who then became a prince of Egypt. Moses started off as a prince of Egypt and then he became a shepherd. Joseph prospered Egypt. Moses devastated Egypt. Remember, under Joseph, all this wealth flowed into Egypt. But under Moses, when the Israelites leave Egypt, they take the wealth with them. Joseph led his people in to Egypt. Moses led his people out. Joseph was loved by Pharaoh, and Moses was hated by Pharaoh. And what makes the difference? How could two lives be so similar? Two deliverers who go to these far countries are hated by their brethren to some degree or other. They take Gentile brides. I mean, there's so many similarities. But then, on the other hand, they're so opposite. One has to be with this eternal perspective, this temporal perspective. It depends on whether you're a Pharaoh who loves God's deliverer or hates God's deliverer. And that's what makes the difference. Your world, and this, I know this sounds like some kind of New Age mumbo jumbo, but if it is New Age mumbo jumbo, they borrowed it from Torah. And that is this: your world depends on how you see it. We need to view it through the eyes of Torah. We have to view it through who God is. And then that will be your world. And that will be your experience in it. But if you view the world without the light of Torah, without God's guidance, without His truth, then that will be your world and your experience in it. It's absolutely true. You can take it to the bank. It's not name it, claim it stuff. But the world you experience will be what your relationship with God is. The two are the same thing. You want to change the world? Then look at it differently. See it as God's. See yourself as hidden with Messiah and God. See your life as not your own. You've been bought with a price. Don't belong to yourself. You're His. See the world as something He's created and He is sovereign of. And see Him in every action. And that even the destroyer is His. That Satan is not an equal and opposite enemy of God. Because as I've told you so many times before, the scriptures prophesy that the enemy is destroyed by the breath of His lips. He's gone. That's all he is compared to God. Off he goes. He's done. He's less than a flake of lint. That's all he is. Okay? Well, let's close and... when I think of all we haven't talked about, it boggles the mind. But I'm looking forward to our Midrash next Shabbat. And so if you have questions or insights, please make a note of them and bring your notes with you next week. And there we can just take all the time we want and talk about these things. Because I love hearing from you, and it's a blessing to hear all the things you have to share. So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you again for this time together. Thank you for granting us our portion, your Torah. Lord, I pray that you would help us to change our viewpoint so that it is an eternal one, and that we will see things as you see them. Lord, I'm reminded of the story of the prophet and the man who looked out. And the man, when he looked out, all he saw was the enemy, armed and ferocious and numerous, coming against them. But then the prophet spoke to him, and then he could see your army as well. And then his heart was at peace. Lord, help us to see the unseen. Help us to realize that the invisible, that's what's eternal. And the visible is just temporary. So Lord, help us to live in the real and in the eternal and in the things the world cannot see. Open our eyes to truth. And Lord, above all, I pray, as we started off, that we would not just be donkeys loaded with books, but we would be people of the book. And that, Lord, we'd be living Torah scrolls. And that the message and the messenger would be one. That's our prayer, Father. Make us this kind of people. We ask in Yeshua's name. Amen.